Welcome to episode 2 of the Dean's Podcast, the podcast about issues shaping graduate studies in Canada. This podcast is brought to you by University Affairs Magazine. My name is Carolyn Waters, and I'm the Dean of Grad Studies at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I'm also currently the president of the Canadian Association of Graduate Studies, CAGS, for the year 2009. Every month, you can listen in as I talk to other deans, faculty members, postdocs, and graduate students about where graduate studies is going in Canada and internationally. If you have a topic you would like me to discuss, then please don't hesitate to send me an email and I'll see what I can do. In this issue, I talked to Dan Russell, a research scientist at Google, who I caught up with at the Hawaiian International Conference in System Sciences in early January. As a manager of one of the world's leading web companies, Dan's job starts where our job ends in the life of a graduate student. Consequently, he knows whether our students are graduating with the professional skills they need to succeed in their jobs. Listen in as he and I discuss how Google works with recent graduate students as they make the transition into the company's corporate culture. And from there, what he thinks universities can do to better prepare graduate students for jobs in industry. Okay, I'm back. This is Carolyn Waters, and I'm now in Hawaii at the HICS conference. And I have with me today Dan Russell, who's a researcher and a manager of researchers in the industrial setting. So first with IBM and then with Google, and he can explain that more in a bit. So welcome, Dan.
Hi, Carolyn.
Okay, I'm going to talk to Dan today mainly about his perception of what we could be doing better with our graduate students in terms of the transition into working in a research lab in an industrial setting. So I'm just going to let Dan talk about it.
Well, it's a good question because the transition from grad school into industry is a critical point in the life of a professional researcher or a professional person doing, you know, development inside of industry. Let me just talk about Google for the time being. The part of the issue that we see when new grads come in is that there's a big learning process, a sort of postgraduate learning process that you have to go through. You've been taught how to do the basics of computer science, and you've been working with other students, and then all of a sudden you're put into a large organization, typically, and you have to work with a lot of other people using a style that you may not have been taught. And so there's a little bit of, this is true for every organization. If you go into IBM system building or you go into Google system building, it all requires accommodation to the local conditions. So, for example, at Google, we have a particular way of building testing suites. So anytime you write code, you have to co-write the test that goes along with it, the unit tests and all that. And you have to learn that whole method for doing it. Sometimes the conditions that you'll see seem sort of arbitrary or unusual. So, for example, there are coding styles that we have at Google which seem retrograde, but when you dig below the covers, you'll actually discover there are reasons for most of those things, and you have to understand those, and it's important to pick your battles. Don't bother fighting some of those, you know, for example, code formatting layout styles. It's not important. Figure out what's important in doing your transition from school to professional work, and that's a skill you have to acquire. So what I'm trying to say is that when you make that transition from a professional graduate program into actually working in industry, you have to pay attention to what's going on around you and not just sort of latch on to exactly the first project that's assigned to you. Heads up, look around, figure out what the path is, what the career path is from where you are the moment you enter to the sort of the next step, and understand where to build your skills in that context.
So how important is a mentor in all of this?
We provide people with a mentor when they come in, so it's really crucial to us. In the Google environment, there's too much to learn. You just can't pick it up on your own. You really need somebody who's sort of done that business before and can point you to a lot of the right resources. For example, our code base is all open and accessible to everybody inside the company, but it's so big that you can easily spend lots of time sort of hunting around through places that are not useful. So you have to learn the skill of asking the right question to the right person. And that's one of the things a mentor can do for you. Another thing a mentor can do is to give you the bigger picture. So typically when a new person comes in, they feel like a little tiny cog in a vast machine. Now, truth, Google is not that big, but you feel relatively small. Now, a mentor's job is to say, look, you're working on this piece, but it's a part of this larger thing, which is a part of this larger thing to organize the world's information. So how can we do that? And a mentor is partly responsible for emotional stability, getting you in and making you feel good and making you understand what's rewarded and what's not, helping you focus, as well as helping to see the context around.
Not to mention which one of those hills to die on.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's talk a little bit from the other perspective. So when the students come in, what kinds of skills could we actually start building or at least implanting in their minds before they get to you?
Well, I've got a few thoughts about that, one of which is probably the most important one is teamwork skills. Now, everybody knows, and everybody says, oh, sure, we work in project teams in school, and that's something that's important. I guess all I want to do is emphasize that. It really is important. And it's important for you as a grad student working on those project teams to sort of be meta-aware of what's going on in that team. It's not enough just to get the grade, but you're really trying to learn something. It's a deeply important part of your skill set to know how to work in a team. Specifically, I mean things like knowing when to take on a particular sub-piece of the whole project, when to stop working on it, when to tell your team that you're failing, when to decide that another person is failing and going into talking with them. So there's a bunch of sort of social skills and sort of team organizational skills that you have to develop, both for yourself as a member of that team and for yourself as a potential leader of that team. So that's an important aspect.
So is there something in that that could be done in workshops, or is this something we need to get professors to build into their team exercises so that everybody gives out a team exercise, but I suspect precious few think about the objectives in terms of the learning?
Yeah, it's a tricky thing to teach. It's a little bit like lecturing to someone about how to ride a bicycle. You can do it, but you have to ride the bicycle. On the other hand, it is useful to reflect on the teamwork that's been done. So one of the things I would suggest is at the end of the term, when the project is done, you step aside and say, let's do a postmortem. Let's go through and talk about what worked in the sequence of that project, what didn't work and why. Do it in a sort of blameless kind of way, doing a realistic assessment of the skills of the individuals, of the team, how it progressed. Importantly, learning what didn't work and why. So when you discover those holes, you can start to figure out how to avoid them next time.
Mm-hmm. So that actually applies across all disciplines. It's not, there might be some one guy in a bench science lab, but all the rest of us need to work in a team. Okay, so what's second on your list?
I think the second thing would be one of the values that we have at Google is looking for innovative or novel solutions. Now, that's a kind of overused catchphrase, but it has a specific meaning for us. In particular, it's the computational demands at Google are very large. So the code you write has to be efficient. Well, sure. But in particular, one of the things we're looking for are solutions to problems that haven't had solutions before. Often that means things like looking at the problem in a really different way. So everybody says, look out of the box, right? Okay, how do we do that? Well, change your assumptions. That's one way of thinking about it. What would it mean if I, instead of having a core processor, had a million core processors, right? So change that assumption. What would it mean if I, instead of having just a few pieces of data, I had billions of pieces of data? So change those assumptions, try to resolve the problem, and come up with a kind of different way of looking at it. Sometimes reversing the assumptions is a useful approach. Bottom line, you have to be able, in order to function effectively in these teams, is to both come up with a different kind of solution, one that works, but also one that can be communicated. So it's not just having the novel solution, but also being able to work in that team and communicate that idea, as well as getting it to function in the engineering sense.
Well, I would suspect, this is a little off topic for the interviewer, they'll have to put up with it. That part of it is recognizing that your bright solution maybe isn't going to work, so that you actually have a reflection in your own, in the actual interpretation of this innovative approach that you have, and I don't know how you would teach that.
Right. Well, as a mentor, one of the things I tell my mentees is try to look at your solution with the most acerbic eye you can have. What's the worst way you can think about that? Is it really trivial? Is it really obvious? What are the failure conditions? Try to understand that. And in some sense, that will give you a different perspective that other people on the team or other people in your group and so on might look at it. It's important to understand those, because you can prove your own novel solution to be a terrible one because there's some base extreme case that you haven't thought about. And in general, it's a good skill to have in order to be able to get at the deeper sense of these novel, interesting system buildings it's all about.
So something we talked about yesterday briefly was the notion of gumption and how we could use a little more gumption in students who are being let loose on the Googles of the world. So do you want to talk about that again?
Sure. What I mean by gumption is just the mindset or the personality style, which says, I'm going to go and drill down to a solution, and when little problems and little barriers come in my way, I'm going to just roll right over them. And it's an important sort of stylistic thing to have, particularly for software engineers, particularly for people who come into Google. The assumption is that everybody has essentially infinite supply of gumption. If you've got a problem, your job is to go figure out how to solve that problem. And if you can't solve the problem, you better come back and say why you can't solve that problem in an interesting, deep way, not just that it was hard to do a lookup on something. Or you didn't tell me how to do it. Go figure it out, right? One of the things you've learned in school is how to do research, how to move forward on a project. So we expect a great degree of gumption from our incoming students. We expect them to be able to not only solve problems, build systems, but then to take sub-problems as they arise and just plow right through them. So if you really get stuck on a sub-problem, that's an opportunity for a novel solution, right? So the other part of gumption is, and I reflect back on the first thing, on the sort of teamwork thing, gumption in the extreme is not being bullheaded, right? It's being able to understand when to stop working on something. Knowing when to quit is an important aspect of working on a team, important aspect of managing your own time. So that's a kind of skill you have to learn. But I think fundamentally, the people who succeed at Google are people who have a lot of gumption, a lot of willingness to drill through those problems and get to the solution.
So what about the notion we hear a lot about management skills, so managing other people, managing projects that graduate students typically aren't taught in any way? Do you need those skills, or do you provide them when they get there?
It's a good question, because every organizational culture has its own style. So there are some fundamentals you can get from your teamwork in school. How to get along with people, being able to communicate your ideas, learning the difference between doing a chalk talk versus actually showing a prototype. But different organizations value different things. So in some places, for example, it's not good enough just to give a whiteboard diagram, but you should just show the working system, right? So for example, at Google, the coin of the realm is really data or prototypes. Just doing a sketch on the back of a napkin will get you started, but it's not worth actually going very far until you can show, at least in a sketch prototype form, that it actually will work, or that you can provide real data. So go out and collect the data, do the analysis, and don't come back with these tiny little numbers of things. Actually show it in a believable number, believable measurement. And at Google, that tends to be fairly large and fairly robust.
So this is actually sort of an entrepreneurial model.
Right.
You know, everybody's their own little business.
That's right. And one of the things about being your own entrepreneur is that you have to figure out if you're going to succeed. Mm-hmm. And that's really sort of where the gumption aspect comes in. And also a little bit with the leadership business, because you have to be able to, as an entrepreneur, work in an ambiguous setting. And the fact that everything's not spelled out is a feature, not a bug, because you can start to work within the freedom that gives you, Okay, so if you're a person who has a problem or an issue with ambiguity, both say in the work setting or in the specification of what the goals are, you should think about this not as a problem but as an opportunity to help to refine and define what those goals and methods and process should be.
So what about communication skills? So in this kind of entrepreneurial model setting, it seems to me that salesmanship and you know, the elevator pitch and being able to make really hot presentations when you're at conferences so that people sit up and listen, that kind of thing. Do you develop those skills?
It's something we consciously work on. I certainly work on it with my people. It is important to be able to have an elevator pitch. Building one of those is not a trivial exercise. It sounds ridiculous, but in fact, the shortest pitches are often the hardest. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like haiku. Every word counts for a lot. Yeah. And the elevator pitch is one of those things that is a skill that actually should be attended to. I can't think of the number of times that I've actually run into somebody in an elevator or the moral equivalent of an elevator and had to describe what I was doing in 45 seconds, right? 45 seconds, you should be able to give the gist of your idea, and if you can't, you need to be thinking about what your idea is or why your communication skill is not up to it. And if so, then develop it. Having said that, different places, again, have their own cultures. So some places really rely heavily on sort of pre-work textual kinds of background information, at which point when the presentation happens, you actually just give sort of the details on that. Other places, the expectation is that you have zero upfront prep, and you have to actually lay out the whole story at that point. I find that the details of whether or not your presentation software has exactly the right serifs or exactly the right background gradients is not as important as saying what the problem is, saying what your solution is, showing the data, wrapping up with a great conclusion. So in essence, the presentation skill is really important, but you need to figure out both how it fits in the culture and how to get the fundamentals across, regardless of the presentation mechanism you're using.
Okay, anything else on that long list?
Oh, no, that's kind of it. Novel solutions, gumption, and teamwork skills. Those are sort of the three things that I assume that you can code, I assume you can do data analysis, and for people who come into my particular area in the sort of user experience research, I also assume that you know how to do experimental design. Now, actually, one of those things, it's one of those things that not a lot of people actually get very good at, and it's relatively tricky, and it's one of those skills that you can forget. So experimental design actually is one thing, if I was to have an ask of the university system, is to emphasize that, at least for my particular area. If you're going to be a software coder, perhaps that's not quite as important. But increasingly, both for small startup situations or for a company like Google, where people fulfill many roles simultaneously, it's important to be able to understand, for example, not just software engineering, but also, say, experimental design, or not just software engineering, but also user experience design or user experience research. So it's important to have a skill focus, but also be aware of how those other parts, those other skill sets operate and how you can connect to them.
So I presume that what you also include in that the notion of understanding other models and the one that you did your PhD thesis on in terms of user studies.
Right. That's almost by definition a postgraduate kind of learning experience. It's good to at least have the fundamentals of that from your graduate, from your schooling, so that you can understand, well, what is the user experience? What is design? What is unit testing?
Why are they just talking to people?
Right.
What's that all
well,
about?
So an interesting attitudinal thing is that a lot of students come, you know, out of school knowing that their discipline is the right one. It's mm-hmm. the primary one, and everything else is sort of secondary. And it's something you've got to get over, right? Everything exists in the ecosystem of a corporate world for some reason. Now, there are certainly our political, you know, reasons why some functions are in ascendancy and some are not, and so on. But don't make the mistake of assuming that your piece is on the top of the heap, right? You're part of this ecosystem. You can be part of it that helps the whole ecosystem get better, or you can sort of not be as relevant. Understanding all those connections and how all they play together in order to emphasize and make the whole system work is crucial.
I love that model of the ecosystem. That's great. My title is the ecosystem. So how long does it usually take you? What's the kind of, does it take 3 months, 6 months for people to kind of make this transition in general? Or what would you expect? You know, if somebody's still 2 years later, I would say that's probably too long.
Well, at Google, I would say the immigration time, again, in my user experience research area, in interaction with search quality, is about a year. It's quite a long time. And all that, I would say, if I broke it down, I would say probably 3 months, 4 months, just to sort of learn the architecture, the systems, all the details about how to actually build code and do that kind of stuff. Probably another 6 months or so to understand how your piece fits into the whole and understand what the rest of the whole is. And probably the rest of that time is just then understanding where all this is going, because Google is like a lot of web companies, it's constantly evolving, constantly changing. And after about a year, you've kind of gone through one whole product cycle, or one whole ship cycle, or one whole cycle of something, and now you're ready to do it again, right? Now, it's true that sometimes things come and go much faster, but at the end of the first year, you've sort of seen all the moving parts. You sort of know what they're called and how they work. So it's a long time, but it's just observationally true.
So do people then, after around a year, actually make conscious decisions? This is for them, this isn't for them?
One of the interesting things about working at Google is how much value we place on people being meta-reflective, meaning that you realize that your passion or your skill set or your intrinsic interests are not in an area or are in an area. So sometimes after about a year, people will say, you know, I'm just not very good at C++ coding.
Me too.
And they'll figure out what else they can do. Yeah. Or their passion really lies in doing something to support, say, the process. Or their passion is really doing something with testing. At which point there's a lot of opportunity to move laterally or to try to find a new place where you actually fit. Because I think, and Google definitely believes this, I think that the best people are the people who are both smart, engaged, and doing something that they really, really care about. And that's, after about a year, you should know that. And that's why I said it's the meta-reflective thing, because that's one of the things you should be thinking about for yourself. Now I see that my passion is in understanding the way people do search, for example, and how can I help Google understand that? So it's a time to sit back and say, how can I change my career? So that's a kind of thing that doesn't happen in school. School, you're pretty much on the path, you exit, you come into industry, you start working, and now it's a different ball game, different rules.
That's it for this episode. If you'd like to get in touch with me about something you heard on this podcast or about an issue that you'd like to see covered, please email me at carolyn.waters@dal.ca. You can also leave a comment at the bottom of the page where this podcast is posted at universityaffairs.ca. Until next time, I'm Carolyn Waters, and thanks for listening.